this introduction is a reconsideration of arguments that were made by Tony Cliff in his biography of Lenin and the account of the role of the Emancipation of Labour group by Samuel H. Baron in his biography of Plekhanov. But it's not a fundamental debunking of everything that Cliff and others in the tradition of socialism from below have written. I take for granted the necessity for Plekhanov and others to struggle for theoretical clarity, to establish a clear Marxist current. For instance, the debate to defeat terrorism and populism, the struggle against economism, Lenin's fight to defeat Menshevism and to establish the need for a vanguard workers' party. The historical evidence on which I base my introduction, much of which Cliff probably didn't have access to at the time he wrote his biography of Lenin, emphatically clarifies, in my opinion, the critical role of a theoretically clear organisation, even if it is very small and isolated at times. Tom Freeman, who shared the fundamental politics of Socialist Alternative until his premature death a few years ago, defends in a thesis he wrote Lenin's view that the ideas of socialism are brought to the working class from outside. He always has that in inverted commas. He argues that this is not an inherently elitist attitude, and it certainly didn't represent elitism on Lenin's part. He shows that Lenin's theory is backed by the evidence of how the Russian workers' movement developed and how a layer of worker intelligence, as he calls them as a translation of some Russian word, as he says that, you know, sorry, he shows that Lenin's theory is based on the evidence, is backed up by the evidence of how the Russian workers' movement developed and how this layer of worker intelligence capable of leading the mass of workers in revolution developed and the role of intellectuals in that process. So to begin, Tony Cliff says of the Emancipation of Labour group in exile in the decade 1883 to 1893, it was practically the whole of the Marxist movement, and that was his emphasis. Baron doesn't qualify it at all. He simply says it was the movement. And Cliff paints what I regard as quite a mechanical picture of the Emancipation of Labour group existing in grand isolation until an upturn in industrial struggle in the early 1890s, in which they could then intervene and win support. Mick Armstrong, in his book, From Little Things, Big Things Grow, that we sell in our stalls, is less categorical. He says that in the 1880s, the Emancipation of Labour group lost all organised contact in Russia, though unknown to them, some Marxist groups did develop. Now, because of Mick's emphasis on the importance of the path-breaking work of Plekhanov and the Emancipation of Labour group, he just leaves it at that. But in a footnote, he references one of the principal sources that I've drawn on for this discussion, a book by Norman H. Neimark, and I've got a reading list for people at the end with some of these books on it. Cliff, in his biography, quotes a historian approvingly to say that until 1893, labour unrest in Russia had no connections whatsoever with any of the social democratic units. And what I want to show is that the evidence points to a much richer experience and a complicated process by which a layer of revolutionary workers and students developed, out of which Lenin could eventually build a serious party in the 1890s. And students were central in seeking out workers, helping them with their struggles. But on the other hand, workers would approach students and intellectuals for help with both the theory and with practical tasks, especially to get written material. Also, beginning with the earliest workers' organisations in Russia, there was a fertilisation of ideas by contact with the European socialist movement. The Northern Union of Russian Workers was set up in 1877 under the leadership of two workers, Stepan Kalturin and Viktor Obnorsky. Both of them had travelled abroad as mechanics and blacksmiths, and they were both influenced by German social democracy as well as the leading lights of the Narodnik movement, Lavrov and Axelrod. Alan Woods, the Trotskyist historian, says, Kalturin was an outstanding representative of a type, the worker propagandist, active in the circles in the first period of the Russian labour movement. And in 1879, the Northern Union played a key role in textile workers' strikes. The union published a couple of issues of a paper, Workers' Dawn, in a print shop established by Kalturin, and Obnorsky made contact with a workers' group in Warsaw. At the age of 15 or 16, Kalturin had been in contact with revolutionary intellectuals in exile where he grew up, and Plekhanov was heavily involved in the strikes as a member of Zemla I Volya, in other words, while he was still a populist. And Freeman comments, "In fact, almost all the worker leaders of the 1870s were involved with the liberal intelligentsia, and in particular, its most radical elements, the populists. And their ideas, the populists, influenced, and all their debates, influenced the political ideas that dominated the worker leaders." In the mid-80s, a number of strikes, some of the most notable in the Nevsky district in Petersburg, which has a continual history, articulated demands in written form. They used advanced methods of organising, and they won widespread solidarity. And Freeman says about one of them, "Echoing the earlier period, the strikers' demands were formulated from outside by a Narodnik, and 200 workers demonstrated to present their demands, beginning their manifesto to the Tsar with the words, 'We address you as children to a father.'" This is pretty typical terminology. But a tiny number of worker intelligence, along with some intellectuals, became to query the theories of populism, eventually turning to Marxism. And Freeman concludes, "Just as Lenin posed the reality of a worker intelligentsia throughout his polemic against the economists, so even in these earliest interactions, it is clear that worker leaders were active and critical in their acquisition of a critique of Tsarism from outside, rather than passive and uncritical in the sense that is usually taken from Lenin's polemic. Out of the study circles that were set up by students and intellectuals, worker intellectuals capable of leading other workers developed, and often in actually quite paradoxical ways, because Obnorsky became the worker leader, the leader of the Northern Union. He became the worker leader that he was via running a workers' library set up by the populists. And this was not an atypical route by which they became revolutionary and identified with Marxism. Now, Lars Lee, in his monumental book, Lenin Rediscovered, sums up how the Bolsheviks understood the relationship of intellectuals to workers later in the Iskra period, which backs up Freeman's thesis. He says, "The workers are presented throughout as students who need the education provided by the social democrats, adult students who know what it is they do not know and why they need to know it. The social democrat teachers are occasionally abashed to see that the students move ahead of them in finding new methods of struggle." And again, there were worker and student circles debating the ideas of Marxism, if a lot of the time in a very confused way. If we take the student Blagojev circle, they developed a commitment to Marxism independent of Plekhanov. They were in St. Petersburg, and they contacted the Emancipation of Labour group in 1884. Now, they organised about 15 circles, each of 8 to 10 members in St. Petersburg, mostly metal workers and printers. They ran benefit societies, a central library, and several mobile libraries. They published 2 editions of an illegal paper, The Worker, which included articles from the Emancipation of Labour group. They appear to have received a shipment of material, including Emancipation of Labour group publications, in 1886. Now, the group had eclectic ideas, but Blagojev unequivocally declared himself a Marxist, and his circle between 1884 and 1887 helped disseminate the ideas of the Emancipation of Labour group. And Neumark concludes, "They shared with Narodnaya Volya workers, and they're the populist, that's the populist organisation, an infatuation with Marxism and an awareness of the revolutionary significance of the industrial proletariat." A bit later, Brusnev, a Bulgarian student, founded a group in 1889 in St. Petersburg that included activists from the earlier Tachisky Circle, known as the Partnership of St. Petersburg Artisans, said to be one of the earliest Marxist circles. Pavel Tachisky had founded his circle in 1885, and he was notable for his strong opposition to populism. He downplayed the role of intellectuals within the workers' movement and emphasised that workers had to build their own independent organisations with their own leadership. Now, Brezhnev appears to have organised a central student circle for some time, and he and Tachisky helped set up a central workers' circle, a city-wide organisation at the centre of 20 circles, which helped organise or support a number of important strikes and political demonstrations, including the first May Day in Russia in 1891 and then again in 1892. And Freeman says, they pioneered the organisation of Marxists within the worker intelligentsia of St. Petersburg. There was terrible repression in 1892, which led the workers' circles to increasingly seek the involvement of dissident intellectuals to help with their propaganda. But again, this did not imply subservience to the intellectuals. The workers intervened into the disputes between the populists and the Marxists. And another historian, Derek Offord, concluded, workers' circles proliferated in St. Petersburg even more or less independently of the intelligentsia by the end of the decade of the 1880s. However, Freeman points out that the last years of the 1880s were really probably the lowest ebb for the revolutionary movement and the workers' movement, and therefore the propaganda of the Emancipation of Labour group and the activists inside Russia was increasingly abstract, reflecting their isolation from the workers' struggles. But nevertheless, Brezhnev's group was the base from which came those who made the turn to intervention in the early 90s, representing the culmination of Plekhanov's work in setting up Emancipation of Labour group. And it was the remnants of both these student and worker milieus, which at their height, incidentally, had organised possibly up to 2,000 workers in St. Petersburg, who influenced Lenin when he arrived in 1893. Lenin joined a circle led by only a couple of leaders of Brezhnev's student circle who had escaped arrest. That was Stepan Ivanovich Radchenko. Radchenko was leading workers' circles in the Nevsky district, helped by V.A. Shelganov, who was an activist in the Central Workers' Circle and who went on to be a Bolshevik of some standing. And I'd argue that if Lenin took anything from this milieu he entered in 1893, it would have been the dynamic interaction between intellectuals and workers and the ability of workers for critical thought and action. And the point I want to make about these circles is that they were organised on the strict lines of strictest security. So that's one of the reasons it's so difficult to find out about them. And Cliff sort of implies that the reason we didn't know about them was because they weren't particularly relevant. And also emphasising the instability and their short-lived existence of all these different circles, as Cliff does, obscures the fact that there were many links and continuity. We've already seen one between Tachisky and the Brezhnev circle. But often there were links made because revolutionaries had to move to escape arrest, and when people went into exile, they often organised as well. For instance, in a month-long strike by 11,000 workers in the Morozov cotton mill in 1885 in the province of Vladimir, the presence in the factory of experienced agitators was critical. And two of those experienced agitators had been involved in the Northern Union in St. Petersburg, one of whom was in the famous Kazan demonstration of December 1876. And the 1885 strike made a huge impact, partly because of its militancy, but then also because of a court case where 33 workers were on trial, and it revealed all the conditions of the factory. And in fact, the workers were all let off, which was, to the absolute horror of the conservative press. And to give you a sense of the kind of repression, 600 people were exiled from the area after that. But Plekhanov was inspired by this strike, and it appears to have played a role in convincing intellectuals around Russia of the revolutionary potential of the working class. On the other hand, the workers learned as well that they needed the help of the intellectuals to help write leaflets and, very critically, to raise funds. And it played a role in turning the tide towards the upturn of industrial struggle in 1889 to 1900. And so in spite of confusions and enduring softness on terrorism, the circles that emerged from the 1880s provided fertile ground for the ideological clarification spurred on by events from time to time. And Offord says correctly that apart from the specific lessons they learned, such as, you know, starting to clarify theories, seeing the potential of the workers, learning about the organisation, the most fundamental point to make about the groups of the 1880s, obscure as they may seem, is this. Namely, that these groups simply existed and functioned, thus keeping alive a revolutionary tradition that could be reinvigorated in the 1890s when conditions were again propitious. And we can add, I think, that the importance of the Emancipation of Labour group cannot be overstated. Its publications turn up everywhere, and it played a role in the desperate need for clarification of ideas out of the theoretical muddle caused by the rise and decline of populism. Tom Freeman also argues persuasively that in the decade 1885 to 1895, worker struggles were developing a new sophistication facilitated by a growing involvement by the worker intelligence with the general anti-Tsarist intelligentsia and the consequent consideration of disputes within that milieu, you know, the debates about ideology. Neumark says that after a period of growth from 1888 to 1891, worker circles began to clarify ideas more seriously, and we saw a new development when the Central Workers' Circle in St. Petersburg organised debates between people representing the different political currents. And so in the first half of the 1890s, a tiny but cohered layer of radicalising workers is evident. Of 1,000 people who participated in the funeral of the beloved populist writer N.V. Shelgunov in April 1891, 100 were workers mobilised by the Central Workers' Circle, and they projected an independent class presence. They sent a delegation to the dying poet to thank him for his work in teaching them and in exposing their conditions. And they led the funeral procession, carrying a banner and a wreath clearly identified with the working class. And then the first May Day occurred a week later as a direct response to a call from the First International of Marx and others and organised by the Central Workers' Circle. And Freeman says, the leadership of the Central Workers' Circle came from within a layer of some 1,000 self-educated workers who could now be regarded as the core of the worker intelligentsia, which, according to one estimate, possibly numbered up to 100,000 workers in study circles in St. Petersburg alone. In 1891 in St. Petersburg, students had formed new circles among workers after a round of repression. In 1892, when one of the participants brought back publications by the Emancipation of Labour group, a circle of students, including Martov, later, you know, a future collaborator of Lenin and then a Menshevik, adopted the name Petersburg Emancipation of Labour Group. Now, Tom Freeman's thesis is all about St. Petersburg, but Neumark studied the police records and he revealed a vivid picture of revolutionary activity across the whole of Russia. Between 1887 and 1892, which is his period, there were social democratic groups in Kharkov, Odessa, Kazan, Kiev, Riga. In the industrial towns of Ivanovo, Voznesensk, Orekhovo, Zuevo, and in several backwaters such as Belgorod, Nezin, and Tobolsk. Lenin, remember, became a Marxist in Samara after participating in the Narodnaya Volya group in Kazan. And in some places, these circles had a lasting influence. In Saratov, in 1901 to 1902, workers actually published 10 issues of their paper, Rabochaya Gazeta, Workers' News, which was, you know, a huge achievement in the conditions of illegality and that. And they are said to have had no involvement from intellectuals. And Konachikov, who became a Bolshevik, later recalled their work with pride. He said, from a conspiratatsia standpoint, meaning the ability to avoid arrest and maintain security, the printing and publication of the workers' newspaper was so well organized that when many of us were later arrested and the gendarme charged some of us with direct or indirect participation in putting out the newspaper, they were incapable of proving anything. And today, when we find ourselves in possession of the archives of the gendarme office, obviously after the revolution, we can see how little was revealed there about the identities of the paper's organizers and collaborators. And being able to maintain this level of conspiratatsia, being able to avoid arrest, was an enormous achievement and a source of pride of people who stayed out of arrest for a few months at a time. Also a source of Marxist ideas in many of the provinces was the Polish Marxist organization set up by Rosa Luxemburg with Leo Jogiszewski and Felix Dzerzhinsky. Jewish radicals played often a key role in promoting Marxism or some, you know, versions of socialist ideas in Odessa, Ekaterinoslav, Kiev, Minsk and Vilna, reflected in the fact that while they were 4% of the population at the Congress of the in the 1903 Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party, they made up 1/3 of the delegates. And to give you a sense of how, you know, the links were made, Tochiski, of the Partnership of Artisans of St. Petersburg, he ended up in Odessa in exile, as did many Jewish radicals, and they were all involved and played roles in organizing circles. So Poles, Ukrainians and other nationalities were prominent in circles in a whole lot of provinces. Now, I can't go into the enormous detail that is available now, but I'll just give you some taste of the extent of the organizations which identified as social democrats. There was a rich library of social democratic literature housed inside the Pavlov textile plant in a town in the Caucasus. The career of Nikolai Fedosayev is both typical but also, you know, individual. In Kazan in the late 1880s, like most revolutionary students, he was interested in incorporating the ideas of Marx into a broad ideology to attract, all the currents of radicalism into a liberation movement. And his group's main contribution to the development of the Marxist movement was their publication program. They assembled, according to Neumark, one of the most impressive underground libraries in Russia. It included works of Marx and Engels, Plekhanov, Kautsky on Marx's economic theory, and Narodnik literature. In January 1892, Fedosyev, after becoming a Marxist during a 15-month stint in jail, was exiled to Vladimir, where he wrote a programmatic pieces for a workers' circle based in that Morozov textile factory of 1885 fame. And he hammered away at one basic theme. The Tsar is not a friend of the workers, but to the capitalist factory owners who are determined to suppress every aspect of aspiration of workers. The police regarded the Social Democratic Circle in Tiflis in 1887 as more dangerous than Tchaikovsky's Circle of Skilled Workers in St. Petersburg. And the group in Tiflis got illegal material and guidance by contacting students who were in exile in the area. In Kharkov and Rostov-on-Don, in Kazan and Vladimir, students and workers were debating, they were organizing, making links, collecting libraries. Now, the libraries were eclectic, to be sure, but they made available Marxist literature to all those who were searching for answers to the political problems that they faced. And they often wrote programs to clarify what they stood for. One such program in Kharkov began with, "We are socialists because we think that the best structure of society is one in which the means of production belong to the producers. You can see the influences, and they described themselves as revolutionaries. They agreed that political terror was justified as long as it carries a propagandistic character, and in self-defense, it was always permissible because you always had to say what you thought about terror. The questions of populism lingered on for a long time. So out of this, it should be clear that the development of the worker intellectuals depended heavily on the work of students, and this is a fact virtually ignored by Tony Cliff. The students are only of interest to him when they're involved in mass struggles, but their untiring efforts, punctuated by arrest and exile, helped disseminate the ideas not just of the Emancipation of Labour group, but of all the Marxists of the time. And in Moscow, we get the clearest profile of the role of the students, because for some reason there, they tended to be more separate from the workers' circles than in St. Petersburg. In the early 1880s, a number of revolutionary students tried to set up groups in the military, one of the earliest being a Moscow University student, described as one of the leading early propagandists of the works of Marx and Engels in Russia. The Society of Translators and Publishers translated Marxist and other socialist material because the military officers were some of the few who didn't read other languages, you know, out of the literate population. And their translations, including Engels' Conditions of the English Working Class, his Socialism, Utopian and Scientific, these two works, they crop up regularly everywhere, in libraries and in parcels that are arriving from overseas. And they were distributed in Kharkov, St. Petersburg and Warsaw, as well as in Moscow where they were published. Their own written material, this Society of Translators and Publishers, emphasised the working masses by 1884, and they were said to support and have good contact with the Emancipation of Labour group. And some of the students involved referred to the worker intelligentsia, and they talked about workers needing to develop their own conscious leadership. Another prominent student argued for propaganda beyond the military and made links with Blagojev in St. Petersburg in 1886. And at least one of the leaders from these circles in Moscow attended the first Congress of the Second International in 1889, returning with a pretty complete library of the Emancipation of Labour Group works. In 1891, Brezhnev had to leave St. Petersburg to escape arrest, goes to Moscow and organises circles there. But as elsewhere, of course, the confusion between populism and Marxism was not settled for a long time. For instance, Kurnatovsky, who was still, while he was still a member of Narodnaya Volya, taught Marxism. You know, so he's in a populist organisation teaching Marxism, and he later went on to be a leading Bolshevik. Throughout the late 1880s into the early 90s, there were regular contacts with the Polish Marxists, and representatives visited a small, reportedly highly sophisticated circle of Marxists at the Polytechnic School in Riga, and they returned again with Plekhanov's writings. And out of this ferment, one of the workers' circles in Moscow decided to form a Russian Revolutionary Party, which included circles in the Caucasus and Kharkov, and later established contact with circles in Kiev. So then when an envoy arrived from the Emancipation of Labour group in early 1892, there was a ready audience for their material, although the three who met him, one of whom was Brezhnev, refused to give any names of any of their contacts. And again, this is another reason it's so difficult to unearth their history, because no one ever wanted to give any evidence of anyone involved. But they did, however, agree to contribute to a fund for further material from the Emancipation of Labour group as long as they were given the sole rights to distribution. So it had something of a commercial sense as well. Or a political sense of, you know, we want to be the ones. Now, some historians assume that workers had separate circles because of hostility to the student intellectuals, and this is a continuing theme which I'll say a bit about. But while the workers might be in separate circles, they quite unselfconsciously sought out the students and intellectuals to provide leaders and written material. Going right back to Karl Turin in the 1870s, Plekhanov wrote of him, that Karl Turin willingly met students and tried to make their acquaintance, getting every kind of information from them and borrowing books. He often stayed with them until midnight, but there was always an element of irony in his relation with the students. He looked upon the workers as more solid and, so to speak, more natural revolutionaries. And this was also a fairly common attitude among some of the worker revolutionaries. And there's abundant evidence that the separate circles rarely implied either ideological or sociological hostility between workers and students. Some students thought that, you know, they were the theorists and workers were the receivers of their programs. But the most common reason for the separate circles was the question of security, because the police often targeted the students and intellectuals. So the circle that Lenin joined in St. Petersburg in 1893 was limited to intellectuals because Radchenko, who led the group, imposed the strictest of security, and this included staying separate from the workers' circles. So out of all of this, a layer of worker intellectuals was gradually developed from the small, unstable, and often unclear worker and student circles. And it was into this layer, tiny as it was, of worker intelligence that Marxists had to intervene. And Plekhanov wrote that they desired to appeal to the broad masses, but were obliged for the time being to confine our popular literary efforts to the narrow circle of more or less intellectual leaders of the working class. And the role of Plekhanov and the Emancipation of Labour Group was critical in developing a tiny layer of student and worker intellectuals committed to genuine Marxist ideas out of the confusion experienced, the confusing experiences of the newly emerging working class and its efforts to find a voice, to say nothing of the theoretical muddle among the anti-Tsarist intellectuals. By the time Lenin joined the circles in St. Petersburg in 1893, this layer was a ready audience in which he could make his own unique intervention. And one important polemic that Lenin waged was against the economists. Now, Cliff puts the rise of economism down to a flip over from an overemphasis on economics, as a flip over to an overemphasis on the economic struggle as a corrective to the overemphasis on theory in the earlier period. But both Freeman and Lars Lee disagree with this. They don't explicitly take this argument on, but Freeman argues that economism is the form in which the demoralization of both the student and worker intelligentsia took in the face of apparently crippling repression and irrepressible economic growth in the late 1890s. And Lars Lee backs up this analysis. He says, he gives a quote from the time that describes the attitude of the economists. They said, "The old banner of revolutionary social democracy frightened off the average worker. This banner must be furled and finally thrown aside." So it wasn't just a flip-flop between theory and economic struggle. You get a sense of where it came from. In 1896 to 97, textile workers led an upturn in industrial struggle, and over the course of these strikes, some 1,000 workers were arrested in St. Petersburg, roughly equivalent to the entire politicized peak of the worker intelligentsia, and some 56 were expelled from the city, according to Freeman's research. And also the revisionist, determinist ideas coming from Bernstein in Germany helped provide an ideological justification for economism. And you can find their material and their arguments and their publications in the publications of the economists. Now, many historians accept the self-definition of the economists. It goes like this. Workers who had found their feet were supposedly fighting for their economic demands and rejected the intervention of elitist intellectuals who wanted to artificially introduce politics into their unreceptive ranks. Now, this suits historians who reject the idea of self-emancipation of the working class. but it also fits with the polemics against Lenin as being an elitist. But Freeman points out, despite rhetoric about worker self-activity, as well as its supposed worker composition, the leadership of the Economist trend actually comprised both student and worker intellectuals, who were united by the view that workers' struggle should be limited to immediate economic questions. Rabotchaya Missal, the Economist paper, was founded by both a worker and a teacher from the Sunday schools, who would have been an intellectual. The best-known figure responsible for organising the Marxist movement was a medical student, but worker intellectuals and circles based in factories were prominent in opposing economism, one of the best-known being a circle of workers in the Putilov plant. And Lars Lee thoroughly demolishes the argument that economism reflected workers' hostility to the elitism of the intellectuals. So, the 1880s, usually seen as a desert for the Marxist movement, was a time of clarification and tentative experience for a layer of student and workers groping their way towards political understanding, and circles across the breadth of Russia, especially in the industrial centres, were regularly impacted by the ideas of the Emancipation of Labour Group, Marx and Engels, Kautsky, the Polish Marxists, and later the Erfurt Programme, Lee says, was well known and read across Russia. And workers constantly sought out revolutionary literature and participated in all the debates that Plekhanov contributed to. Offord says, by the 1890s, hardly a provincial town of any importance was without its revolutionary propagandists and sympathisers. Students, Jewish intellectuals, Polish Marxists and worker leaders sent into exile took their ideas across the expanse of Russia. And through the circles both of Narodniks and of those groping for Marxism, in the factories in all the major centres, revolutionaries, according to Offord, maintained a connection with the masses and thereby facilitated the building of a working class movement when the pace of industrialisation quickened in the 1890s and when the growth of unrest among the urban workers made it more than ever desirable for the revolutionaries to cultivate them. Now, economism took its toll. It became influential among the 400 members of the Union for the Struggle for the Liberation of the Working Class of St. Petersburg, they have such long names, which Lenin had helped establish. But a breakaway group, Workers' Flame, with 25 members, organising 18 circles, stayed in touch with Plekhanov between 1897 and 1900. But the disintegration of the revolutionary intellectual circles and the decline in struggle in the late 1890s led to increasingly abstract propaganda and even for some of the groups to renounce strikes. But in spite of incredible odds, there was some continuity over two decades of theoretical debates and struggles. You'd wonder how people even survived, let alone that the continuity could exist. So in 1900, there were a number of propagandist groups composed of students and workers which provided the base for Lenin's projected new paper when he again attempted to make contacts in St. Petersburg. And Freeman says 1900 to 1905 was a period of dogged struggle to re-establish a Marxist current intervening concretely within workers' struggles. And one of the important periods or events was the spring events in 1901, when workers mobilised in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, Kharkov, Ekaterinoslav, Tiflis and Tomsk and possibly other cities onto the streets in support of mass student protests. And with the formation of the pro-Iskra Petersburg Committee, for the first time since the 1890s, most social democrats were in one organisation, but as you will know, they split again in 1903 at the Second Congress of the RSDLP. And Lenin had to complete the task of clarifying the theory and political programme of a genuinely revolutionary organisation, now against Plekhanov and against Martov, who had been Lenin's collaborator in establishing Iskra. And Lenin's polemics against these two and his determination to establish a serious Russia-wide organization of revolutionary worker intellectuals, in other words, to build a vanguard party, was the final act in the establishment of the Bolsheviks, a project that was not completed until the test of the 1905 revolution. And it's this debate which, as much as anything, building on the arguments made in the what is to be done, which plays the central role in the demonization of Lenin. Even people in the revolutionary left hesitate about Lenin's arguments. Tony Cliff and John Molyneux of the International Socialist Tendency argue that Lenin had to break from his elitist ideas about intellectuals bringing ideas to the workers from without in order to relate correctly to the revolutionary movement of 1905. But both Freeman and Lee disagree, and there are arguments really around this particular question are the subject of a whole talk, and they will be touched on again in the session tomorrow afternoon by Mick Armstrong on what is to be done. Lee and Freeman argue, contrary to the necessary break in Lenin's ideas, it is the very continuity of his ideas that explains why he was the leader who best related to the revolutionary movement of 1905. Freeman says, if viewed in context, Lenin's ideas can be seen as flowing from Marx's own contradictory understanding of consciousness. There was fundamental continuity in the role of conscious intervention across the dramatically changing junctures that Lenin addressed. In fact, Freeman argues, the implication of Lenin's theory about worker intellectuals, which was very similar to that of Gramsci, is that workers could become socialist theorists themselves, as long as revolutionary intellectuals did not adopt a determinist passivity in relation to this possibility. And Lee says, the two upsurges of 1905 and 1912 are great historical landmarks for Lenin. His reaction to both can accordingly be not seen as a break from the past, but can be predicted from what he wrote in What Is to Be Done and from his political agitation articles for Iskra. He says that Lenin felt the upsurges proved that the revolutionizing of the workers is as unstoppable as a force of nature, despite the naysaying of intellectuals whose weak faith was shaken by intervening months and years of worker quiescence. Now, the Bolsheviks entered 1905 with about 300 to 400 members out of 800 Social Democrats in St. Petersburg. And this probably amounted to no more than the revolutionary Marxists in St. Petersburg in 1895, but they were significantly clearer theoretically. Lenin claims that thousands of workers across Russia supported them, but they were still marked by the abstract propaganda common in the difficult times. And yet, says Freeman, for all these limitations, the committee responded to the rising movement with an energy and enthusiasm that would allow it to advance and transform itself over the next 2 years. Shulgunov, the Bolshevik long-term worker intellectual and labour movement leader, played a critical role in a joint meeting of Putilov and Semyonikov workers on the 2nd of January 1905, representing the best of the results of 2 decades of what at times seemed like fruitless endeavour. And Tom Freeman argues that while the crisis of Tsarism remained shallow, you couldn't have revolutionaries relating to masses of workers, and necessarily their propaganda was related to an intelligentsia of various class backgrounds. Prior to 1900, he says, this intelligentsia in St. Petersburg was formed through the propaganda of dissident students and young professionals amongst a layer of worker intelligence. And in the reformation of an orthodox movement after 1900, the central role of such elements was even more pronounced than it had been earlier. He says, thus, social democratic organization was centered on a number of prominent higher educational institutions. The secretary of the St. Petersburg Committee became the focus of student activity, and general political activity reflected the cycle of the student year. With class struggle and opportunities for class concrete intervention limited, students predominated within the social democratic movement. And he says Marxism could only take root on a mass scale with a generalized crisis of czarism. And he says, thus, the struggle by Lenin, first against the economists and then the Mensheviks, marked the culmination of a long process of theoretical clarification by identifiable exile leaders outside the working class. In the subsequent growth of Marxism from a small number of isolated intelligents to a significant layer of leading activists, this defensive struggle by the exiled leaders was vindicated. And I'll just finish with this. Lenin's achievement in establishing the Bolsheviks was a final tribute to, but also made possible only because of, incredible suffering, sacrifice, and resolute determination of astonishingly inspirational individuals and groups, some of whose names are recorded mostly in police files, but many of whom remain nameless. And this is a rich history that we need to know because it reminds us that the efforts of small groups of revolutionaries, no matter how insignificant or ineffectual they seem at times, if they're focused on establishing a clear ideological current committed to the theory of revolutionary Marxism, are an essential step on the road to building the mass working class party that we know is needed in order to lead a revolution to bring capitalism to its knees.